we have Graham back with us again this month, which is great. If you didn't catch it last month, he showed off a bunch of his physical access tools. But today,
watch the episode.
We're doing something different. We're going to talk about one of the more memorable penetration tests that we did a few years back now. Mm-hmm. We're going to dive into that a little bit. This one's going to be the school district story.
Sure, yeah. Before we do that, though, I have some gifts for you.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So
This
will be quick. Here's the copy of...
Oh, perfect.
Mistborn that I said.
Irrelevant to the episode.
I got this for $1.
$1.
I love my boss.
It'll go into the collection.
If it ever comes down to it, I need proof here. I love my boss. All right.
recommend the series. So there's that.
Really late, but ooh. Wes bought you these at Cactus Con.
Oh.
And
oh my gosh.
Completely forgot to bring them last time.
All right, I got
to
open these real quick.
So yeah, you should show those off. That is not the con badge. That is another one.
So for context, at all these security conferences that we go to, typically at your more corporate events, you get that little paper name tag. My name's Mike. I'm from Meltech. When you go to the hacker conferences, they do things that are a little bit different. So here's one I'm going to have to put together. It looks like an electronic badge with some LEDs that I'm going to have to solder, some sort of an IC chip.
Yeah.
So this is from CactusCon, which I missed because I was stuck in the Boston airport.
Yeah, that was so tragic.
Stranded, had to drive home.
Yeah.
So that'll go on my badge wall. I have every badge from every conference I've been to since, 2012, something like that. At least 100 of them. And what's this other one?
This one's a hat. It's like night vision goggles.
Okay.
There's a 3D printed hat clip, so you can clip it to your hat and you have nods coming down.
Oh my gosh.
It's really
fun. Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess next month I'm going to have all these put together so I can follow up with the
results with our little NVG.
Awesome.
Sure.
Not the weirdest badge that we've had. Most memorable one I have on my wall is from, I don't remember which DEF CON it was, maybe 23. Where they gave us the entry to get into the conference and to validate that you're supposed to be there was a 9-inch LP physical vinyl disc that have hanging from your neck.
That's good.
The entire time. And it was the most obnoxious thing ever.
No, that's really funny. I don't know how hard it would be to copy that in Vegas. You could probably,
The best part about that was there was a challenge where people needed to go find an actual record player to extract the audio and then solve a challenge.
Oh, that's sick. They put a CTF.
They put a CTF
on it.
On a record.
That's so cool.
I should actually.
Oh, that's awesome.
I should put that on my record player and see what's on there. I never actually got to try it out. So.
Okay, one more.
Thank you.
I got one more.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I'm sorry. These are like all the things that I was told to deliver to you. This is also from Wes. It's a shirt. From his company, you can pick whether or not you want to display the logo or not.
We can display the logo.
All right, so that's a little bit of classy security practitioner humor.
Seems familiar. Threat Sims. Shout out to Threat Sims. They're awesome. Wes, thank you. Thanks for bringing me all that stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, some of the goodies and gadgets we get in the security space here. All right, I'll put these away now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about breaking into a school.
Sure. Not physically. Last episode. Go watch last episode.
Yeah, this one's not breaking in physically. So I guess I'll get that after. Before we get into that, let's set up a couple of things here. Number one, in this specific scenario we're talking about a penetration test that we did for a school.
Yes.
But on the hierarchy of like the types of assessments that we do.
Oh, man.
I think we break them down into like four categories, right? We have... basically, your inventory of things, your threat map, right?
Okay.
That's where we're...
Like asset management, kind of.
Yeah, we're trying to find out
surface management.
What things actually exist for an organization, right, that they might want to protect.
Sure.
Sometimes they have an inventory of these things. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Sometimes they think they do, and often we'll find things that are on the network that people didn't expect. That's in that, like, tier. It's not actually finding vulnerabilities or anything. It's just...
finding things.
Finding the things that we should then go to. For an organization that's looking into security, that would be the first place to start, right? They'll just get a map, get an idea of everything that you have.
Yeah.
The next from there, what a lot of organizations probably implement is some sort of vulnerability management, right? So this is where you're using automation tools that exist to find things that are deviating from the standards or from best practices, your vulnerability scanners, anything related to that that checks for missing patches, missing updates for software, things that have been disclosed that are widely known. And that allows, you know, an organization to really get an idea of low-hanging fruit that they can fix up, right? There's no real human interaction with this. It's just scanners running, providing some results, sometimes good, sometimes not good. Yeah. But we usually include that.
Huh?
We usually include, like, the vulnerability scanning on the higher side, but...
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, vuln scanners cut out a lot of the, like, grunt work of finding very, very basic misconfigurations.
Yeah.
And sometimes they give you threads that you can pull on. If an endpoint, it's not really configured properly, the configurations themselves are not really a huge finding. It still gives you a reason to kind of go look at it. Maybe it is an older endpoint. There's other things that you can really pull out as someone actually behind a keyboard.
Well, some cases it gives you an idea of where there's gaps within the organization itself, right? If you find a lot of things that are missing patches, then that could be indicative of the organization not having like a good process in place for managing and keeping things updated. Yeah. Same with configurations. If you're deploying things or setting things up and just plugging them in without really understanding the ways that you can update them or change them or configure them or lock them down, there could be little holes that can be poked at with the testing that we do. Next phase up. So we have threat mapping, the attack surface mapping, vulnerability.
And automatically patching endpoints is a pen test.
Pen test. And that's where we do most of our work, is in that space.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah. So on the pen testing side, this is for organizations that maybe have those other two levels covered pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to get a person involved to see, okay, what did we miss? What did we overlook? Yeah. What are the automation, what do those tools miss?
Yeah.
And what actual impacts are going to be exposed mm-hmm. by somebody being on our network or somebody poking at our web application or trying to break in? And that's where we have a lot of fun and what the story is going to be about. But just to close the loop on this, the fourth level, really the most advanced level, is what we really call the red teaming, which is where we have an organization that has gone through multiple pen tests maybe and really refined things, and they have a real specific concern that they're trying to test their defenses against, make sure that they can catch and manage like a specific attack. If we have a threat actor that they go after organizations to deploy ransomware, right, to get financial payments or whatever, or stealing information or whatever, there's this very specific scenario. And the goal on the red team assessment is for us as the actors or the emulators here to try and replicate those types of threats and evade all the defenses and see if the organization can catch it and where those loopholes are so that they can really refine things.
Yeah, I've always seen red teaming as testing with SOC too, because it's like on a pen test, sometimes you're just like, okay, like we're going to do an internal assessment. Here's the device. And then everyone in the SOC just knows that the gross amount of packets coming from this one IP, that's just the pen test. Don't worry about it. And the next step of what does your day-to-day active monitoring, how does that stack up against someone who's actually trying to evade detection, as opposed to like me password spraying 1,000 employees off of a virtual machine that you already know about, you know?
Yeah. Now we're going to dive into a little bit for this one particular assessment, which was really memorable. It was one of the, not one of the first ones that you were on, but it was early on in.
Say it was like my first big win.
For sure, your first big win. Yeah. Yeah. Let's set up the
scenario.
We
call it a
here.
Win. It's not a competition. I just want to say that. But it does feel like a win every time you get DA or Enterprise.
Yeah, it's conflicting because when you. Or when we're doing these assessments and these engagements, when we find like a big hack or a big vulnerability and we exploit it, that feels good.
Yeah, you're like, but I'm so awesome.
Yeah.
And you're like, ooh.
Yeah, at the same time, you feel so awful.
You're in so much trouble.
Yeah. And then on the inverse side, when you can't find those things, you feel like a complete failure.
Yeah, and you need to go stand in front of a train.
Yeah, you're happy for the organization because they are doing something really well.
Yeah.
So it's always really a conflicting thing, and there's another story for that. We'll have to see it for another day there. But in this case, we have a school district, K-12 school district, and we're doing a internal penetration test.
Yes.
Why don't you give us a little highlight of what an internal pen test would be for those at home. An overview of that.
Yeah. It's like an external pen test on the inside.
Perfect. You got it.
So internal pen, it is really like an external pen test on the inside. Generally, there's a device provisioned, by us or virtual machine. So you add an endpoint onto the internal network, and then we conduct a pen test from the inside. That I said it as a joke, but it is very similar to an external network assessment in that you're assessing each endpoint and the network services that they have exposed for misconfigurations. I think the biggest difference is that on an external assessment, there's a lot of testing the ways that people can sign on from the outside, SSO and stuff like that. And there's OSINT that you would do to determine your targets for password attacks or MFA kind of stuff. But on the internal, all of that is you're going against like what the policies of the domain specifically are. It's also a lot easier to grab users
sure.
if you're like domain joined. Instead of being like, oh, does their O365 lock you out after a certain amount of failed password attempts, or do they have MFA handled on the external network? You're looking at like the domain password policy and how they kind of handle that stuff internally. Because there can often be mismatches on like how logins and employee behavior is treated originating from the inside as opposed to coming outside, which is a big reason that a lot of EDRs don't catch us, I think, is because they get configured, but then they're too lenient.
Sure.
So it's like, oh, yeah, like Johnny's failed to log in 5 times, but he's just a forgetful guy and it's coming from the inside. So how bad can it be? That's kind of what it is. The assumption is that you're trying to emulate compromise on the network. So you're doing this under the assumption that someone clicked on a phishing email or a web server has been compromised from the greater internet, and now you have a threat actor who's pivoted into the internal network. Where can they go from?
What can they do? Yeah. We're thinking about this specific engagement. It's for a school district, which to me, you know, just brings me back to when I was in school, just like, hey, now you get to actually pretend to be the bad guy. What can you get away with? Mm-hmm. You know, what can you actually do?
Yeah.
And you think about the kids in school, like, oh, I want to change my grades or do whatever. And we actually get to try that out in this situation, just like find all those things. But it's obviously a lot different now with the district. They have so many different types of devices that we don't see everywhere else. I remember for this specific engagement, there was things like the PA system, right? The announcements throughout the school. You have all of the learning devices, the smart TVs.
Yeah.
You have all the student laptops, computer labs, printers.
Didn't you root a smart board?
We'll get into that part too. That was a fun one as well. But so typically in the school districts, you'll have maybe a couple of IT people that are in charge of the whole district and keeping all this stuff secure. And it's just a daunting job.
Oh, it's impossible.
Yeah, just thinking about that from the outside.
Like thousands of devices.
So
there's
now
a lot of BYO now.
There's a lot of that as well. Yeah. So we have this situation where we're getting access to the network just as somebody that maybe plugs something in and then seeing what can we get away with? Like, what can we do? Can we escalate and own the entire network? Can we get into different things? What are we able to do? That was the goal for this, right? Specifically here in New York, they have new regulations and laws to really help protect the student personal information, the student PII, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to make sure that all of these different services and devices aren't scooping up all this information about students and then selling it off because they're all minors. You know, there's all this stuff that they're trying to protect against. Not only the devices and everything themselves, but the student information is a huge part of that.
Mm.
So it is super important for these schools to really get an idea of where those holes are. And that's where we came in. We got to poke around at that and
do
a couple different things.
I forgot about the PA system too.
Yeah.
There was so much going on.
We had to be really careful because we were testing like while school was in session.
Yeah.
We don't want to set off alarms.
Ringing the bell. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. just causing mayhem.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of, you know, movie Hackers where he sets off the sprinklers as in retribution for the pool on the roof.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you have those ideas like, hey, I want to do this stuff, but we have to be careful.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a couple of the notable things from that. So one was the smart boards, right? So
yeah, smart boards was fun.
Those are relatively new-ish. I mean, I'm sure, you know, 7-8 years now they've been in place. But
I remember smart boards being a big thing when I was in elementary school.
Really?
Yeah. Those were the ones that
maybe
like,
I'm way off.
The touchscreen operated like a DS. So they weren't capacitive like your iPhone. They had like an air pocket.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it compressed the film.
Yeah, you had to like push
yep.
the actual board in. I don't think these were those. They were Android devices. That's all I know.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the real interesting things. So almost every classroom had one of these giant TVs, mm-hmm. which the teacher would plug their laptop or their computer into in order to display lessons to do something interactive. Mm-hmm. But like you said, those TVs were just running Android. So it's basically just a giant tablet.
Yeah.
And one of the first things we noticed is that they were not configured at all.
Were they running default or were they open?
Yeah, they're just plug it in, set up on the network, you're good to go. And one of the things we found real quickly is that there was debug mode and you could just get in as root access by connecting to it and just basically saying, hey, I want to be root on this phone. There's a process to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so real quickly, we were able to control all those devices within the network, which that started off interesting. And we kind of left it there. Oh, but
I mean, where do you go from there? It's kind of like, were they network connected?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Everything was on the network. Everything was talking. Yeah.
Oh, brother. Yeah. I don't remember that one as much because that was more, I think you're the one who got that one.
They had a lot of really interesting security devices like the cameras. I remember the camera systems were not just in schools, but
Did the door controller?
That was a different one. That was a different one. Yeah, that had a door controller. For the cameras, they had some outdated software for the cameras, right? So we were able to bypass the authentication and monitor what was happening within the school, which was another one of those situations where you're like, yeah, this is weird. Yeah. I don't love this, but we got to let them know, just seeing you know, what's going on.
Yeah, observing.
But the big win was your win on this one, where we were looking through and mapping out all those devices and a lot of Windows systems, a lot of computers on that network, and we were trying to find the ones that were outdated, the anomalies, right? The things that stuck out.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if that's where it started. You just told me to run Bloodhound. And I was like, okay. I think it was the first or second time I've ever used Bloodhound. So we're going to chalk it up to beginner's luck.
No, definitely not. But it was a new tool that you weren't as familiar with.
Yeah. I want to say either this pen test or the one right after. This might have been the cruise guy. Was the first time I had to use the Python ingester because we couldn't. They gave us a VM, but it wasn't domain joined.
Right.
That might have been
that was the other one. Yeah.
Okay.
That was
That's another good. Episode. but yeah, this one, we got the data and I had no clue what to do with it because, like, it's huge, huge network. And so, this incredibly complex graph.
Just so many devices and just to
and I didn't know the language.
Right.
So I later went to a talk at CactusCon about all of the different things that you can do with Bloodhound by using their query language. But I didn't know at that time. And so I was seriously just going off of the drop down menu on the side.
Yep.
And there were like 3,000 or so, like just a bajillion endpoints on this graph and users and everything they recorded all. I got no clue what to do with it. And so I start looking through the thing on the side and down at the bottom, it was just filter by old devices or like outdated devices. And I just clicked it and the whole graph went and it was eight things.
Eight things. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I could work with eight things. I can do that.
So Bloodhound, just for those that aren't familiar, it'll basically map everything that's on the network that it can find and then create a relationship charts between all these different things. So it'll map out a computer that's on the network and determine what version operating system it's using. It'll map out networks. It'll map out users and the relationships that these have. So then what you can do
is Directory, right?
Yeah, you can do policy information if you're able to collect that. But what you're able to do is say if you compromise a machine on the network, you can tell Bloodhound, hey, I have this network and my goal is to escalate up to somewhere else. So how can I do that based on all of these different objects and all these different relationships? And it'll give you like an attack chain to try and follow or that it has identified. But the way that you ended up using it was, hey, all of these machines.
One and done.
Yeah, there's a few thousand machines on here. Most of them are all updated. And then when you filtered it out, we saw a few
that were old.
So they're just systems that were out of date, that they had been forgotten about.
Yeah, end of life.
And one of them in particular was, we found out later, was in, I think, the bus garage.
It was their gas boy.
Yeah, it was monitoring, I think, the fuel levels or the fuel tanks in the bus garage.
It's a glorified microcontroller, but they had a whole Windows computer running it. I looked it up later. Gasboy is like a whole, it's a whole product, like a hardware product.
Oh, interesting.
That
they,
that serves anyone who maintains vehicle fleets. So they might have extra functionality that it requires a full computer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what they told us was that it just displays the fuel level of their underground tanks so they know when to get more gas.
And so you found
that. Windows 2008.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, I think that I can pop this one.
Well, yeah, so what happened was we... I found it on Bloodhound. I found a bunch of endpoints, and I was looking around, and I was like, okay, like I'm just going to focus on these because they're obviously... Maybe not obviously, but at the time I thought these were obviously the weakest links in the entire network. And I start looking at all of them, and the other ones are just useless, or they didn't really have any sort of exposure. So it was like, yeah, this older Windows 7, but it's like not really old enough to be totally broken. And they're not running like a lot of services. There wasn't a lot of stuff to poke at.
Yep.
So it was like, okay, yeah, there's a Windows 7 box with RPC open, and that's it. I don't really know what I can do with that. And
narrowed it down to that one.
Yeah, I basically, that was the only one that like looked like anything was going on there. It had SMB open. It had unsigned SMB version 1. And I was like, could it be this easy? Could I Eternal Blue this endpoint?
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is awesome. This is just like the CTFs. I'm just going to point Metasploit at this and we're going to go home.
But that didn't work.
It didn't work. So it turns out that Windows 2008 32-bit architecture was like a big thing back then, and Eternal Blue doesn't work on 32-bit systems.
At least the modules that were available.
Yeah, right. The module that is written for Metasploit is 64-bit.
Sure.
That was interesting because I was like, oh, all of the symptoms are here for me to attack the service and get the exploit, but it's compiled for a 64-bit system. How do I downgrade the exploit so that it runs on arcane hardware?
Yep.
And I ended up going on the internet to research this. I ended up on like a Russian forum that was all, because like where else are you going to find cutting edge hacking but having to do it on retro hardware,
right?
Like the former Soviet Union. So I'm on this forum and I don't read Russian, I don't speak a lick of Russian. So I'll take a paragraph and I'll paste it over and translate, and it'll be like, you're such a moron. How could you think that this was going to work? I'm like, okay, that's not it. And then I take the next one and I click, and it's SQL injection for kids is so easy, LOL. And I'm like, all right. And just kept going through these forum posts until I found one that said Eternal Blue. Because like Eternal Blue, they were writing it in English.
Yeah.
So I would like filter out. I found a thread where there was one guy who years ago was like, oh, this is what you need to do to make Eternal Blue work on 32-bit. And then I just modified the Metasploit, what are they called, modules?
Yep.
Yeah, I modified the module.
With those changes.
Yeah.
Recompiled it.
Because the last thing I'm going to do is take Russian code and,
of course,
from the hacker forum and just deploy it.
Sure, just throw it on some random system. Why not?
Yeah.
Just
deploy it. So I was not about to do that on the pen test. So I saw what he did, and then I changed my Metasploit module to kind of work. I made a new one. That was interesting, too, because I'd never written a Metasploit module.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, I'm so neat. This is awesome. Yeah, and then I shot it at it, and it popped.
Yeah, so we got onto that system.
Yeah.
Because of the Eternal Blue vulnerability there, you get access as, like, full system access to the system.
Yeah, NT-authority.
NT-authority. So you have full permissions over that.
Yeah.
And then the question is, well, okay, we own this one box. It
does
something very basic, you know, nothing super interesting. What do we do from here? How do we take this and leverage it to own the whole system, the whole network?
It was cool to have the box, but it's like, yeah, where do you go from there? Because we didn't have any users at the time, I don't think.
Nope.
We didn't have any users or anything. And so it was just like, oh, man. At that point, you basically just have another internal pen test box, but it's harder to deploy your tools from.
Yeah, you can't do much.
What's the point?
It was on the domain, and it was on the network.
Yeah.
So what did we end up doing? We mini-cast it, right? Well, we did do that, and there was some stuff there to pull the plaintext credentials that were in there too.
Yeah.
Also, because this was, we're getting a little ahead here, but since this was a known system that was essentially supposed to be offline, there were times when the network admin would log into that, maybe to shut it down or whatever.
Yeah.
And in Windows, when you have somebody making a connection to it on the domain, it'll cache those credentials, the hashed password, whatever else, on the target system.
Yes.
And once you have full access to it, you can pull all that data down. So what we're able to see is, oh, here's a domain administrator that logged in to do some action, and now we have
it was a service account. Hash. It was a service account.
I think there was a service account and a domain admin that was on
it. Okay.
So then we had hashed credentials from this that belonged to both a service account
and we passed them.
And then we just used that to...
Simple as.
We basically talked to another system on the network and we basically said, hey, I'm this service account or I'm this admin. Here's my hashed credentials, because we don't want to pass them the plain text.
No.
That would be insecure.
That'd be crazy.
So we pass them the hashed credentials and it says, hey, yes, this is valid. I will give you access to the system.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we're able to now start hopping to any system that we want. And then repeating that process, you can pull any cache credentials, anything that's in memory, look at any interesting files. And so really quickly, this whole thing starts falling apart where we're able to gain access to whatever we want, look at any of the files that are on there, and just start escalating real quickly. So some of the things that we end up doing in that scenario is, hey, what are users doing that could be better, right? So we'll find teacher accounts or whatever and say, hey, are they storing just like a little file that says, here's all my passwords, right? Getting into grade books, getting into other services and doing those things. And so really quickly, like the hard part was just getting that initial exploit to fire. And once you get access there, it
just all falls real quick. Apart. That's how it always is, though. If you just need one good foothold, the rest just kind of happens, you know? I guess the crux of it is always getting DA.
Yeah, right? Well, yeah, that's usually our end goal, but we try and be more comprehensive to find additional ways that they can improve things.
Yeah,
but
no, that is true. Pen tests don't end at DA.
For some organizations, they will, but ours, when we try and do that, we try and like be a little bit more comprehensive.
Back it, yeah,
exactly. To recap on that one part, the thing that led to that initial vulnerability is, well, there's two pieces of it. One, that system wasn't patched, either because...
Oh, it was archaic, yeah.
Either the school wasn't in charge of it because it belonged to some third party, and somebody that was supposed to be managing it didn't. But also we ended up finding out after we finished all this, we reached out to that admin and we basically said, hey, we have access to everything. Here's the situation. And he was like, well, what happened? And we told him about that box in the bus garage. And he said... Oh shit. He's like, I had that unplugged because I knew it was an old system.
It's not supposed to be plugged in.
But I don't think that was communicated out clearly. So an employee or somebody at the bus garage was like, oh, this system's offline or the system's unplugged. Yeah. I'm just going to plug it back in. Maybe it got unplugged accidentally. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, that
unplugged
vulnerability
meaning
exists.
Like not physically connected to the network. It was still on.
Yeah. So they plugged
but
it back
just
in.
Not on the network.
And
yeah.
As a result, the whole house of cards comes tumbling down.
Yeah.
It was a real interesting scenario. So there was the stuff with the bus garage. We had all the interesting devices, the PA system.
Yeah.
And that would end up being a lot of fun. The school was happy, right? They were happy that we found all these things that they could fix. They were upset with the
someone
state
in the bus
things.
Garage probably got yelled at.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that they...
Or they just took all the Ethernet cables out.
Yeah. I don't know what ended up happening there. We haven't done a follow-up since then. I think it went to another vendor in the subsequent years. I mean, what's your recommendation there for that scenario? How does an organization protect against that sort of thing? I mean, to me, it seems like you need to communicate those risks to somebody that may not understand what's going on there. Like, hey, this is unplugged. Here's why.
For a reason. Yeah.
If you need it, please let me know so that I'm aware of this. But you still have that other scenario where this thing is managed or hosted or provisioned by some external entity.
Nah.
So who's in charge
of it? Well, I mean, the bus garage, where I went to school, the bus garage is still like part of the...
Well, I'm saying like the Gas Boy side of it. If that was provided by Gas Boy or whoever it was.
Oh, the device. I didn't even think about that. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Are they the ones that are supposed to keep it up to date or is it the result of the organization? Like those are the types of things.
That kind of bureaucratic stuff always gets in the way of like effective security, I feel. It's like... You have a vendor and just like becomes not your problem. Or you can't touch it because they have some sort of warranty or agreement. It's the same thing where I feel there's a common complaint with security practitioners is threat actors don't care about scope.
Yeah.
They're going to do whatever they need to do to get in. And so if that means that they go after a third party, if they go after a vendor and use that to pivot to you, then that's what they're going to do. They're not going to be like, oh, this is not part of your domain.
Right.
So I'm not going to touch it. They're going to be like, I'm going to beat your CEO in his own home until he gives me the access I need.
That's, yeah, pretty extreme example. But
well, yeah. As security controls get more and more advanced, my belief is that more primitive or fundamental TTPs will start to become more prominent again.
I agree.
Yeah. If you perfect encryption, you now are basically required to compromise the actual endpoint, right? So people are going to be busting into stuff a little bit more.
Yeah. You also
knocking
have this
heads.
The scenario with people with remote access to things now, right? Working hybrid or working from home.
Oh, yeah.
Having access to log into the work network, school network, whatever the case may be. And now, they're getting targeted at home.
Fluffy bunny.
Yeah, exactly. So
sitting in a van with a Yagi.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
You're targeting people at home through their home systems, home routers, those types of things.
Sure.
And then, oh, wow, this person works for X, and now I can sniff what they're doing, compromise their machine, and get in through that route. But the other side of it.
Take the RSA key off their nightstand.
Yeah, that's...
But I can't do that. I'm a pen tester.
That's not in scope for us. Yeah.
Breaking and entering is only in scope on some engagements.
Only for some of them.
Only for some.
So yeah, that was the school story. That was a lot of fun. That was one of many schools that we've done in the past.
Yeah.
But.
School districts, medical facilities. There's certain clients where they come across our desk and you're like, yeah, like these guys are getting popped. A lot of public service is very underserved, but they have so many critical functions. It's like WannaCry, when WannaCry was like hitting hospitals, because they have, you know, their life support system, they can't turn it off, it's running, you know, Windows NT, that kind of stuff. There's like the whole budgetary issue, because I do feel like every time we work with a school district, it's okay, how are we going to make this work for you guys on the books,
right,
from the financial side of it, because those are the people who need this kind of work done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Freaking Joe Wall Street. We do financial institutions. They have very minimal threat exposure.
Yeah.
They're whipping their employees to use MFA and everything. It's like, you don't need the testing. I mean, you do, but you don't need it as much as a school or a hospital or some sort of not-for-profit. Everybody gets targeted.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's indiscriminate. So you have the functions that they serve are so much more important than some of the other ones, and yet they are struggling to get by. And if you think about it from the school district, we just voted on the budget for the schools
year. Oh, we did too, yeah.
And you look at it, and it's like they have $100+ million for the year. Like, think about that from an organizational standpoint. That's a large organization, to handle that amount of budget each year, and to have so many things to be responsible for, not only for the employees, for the staff, everything that, but for all the students and everybody too. Mm. It just seems like there's still a little bit of a disconnect on ensuring that they have the resources that they need in order to properly secure things.
Yeah.
Unless we're talking about physical security, they're usually on top of that side of it. But on the network side,
in America. This is such a hot topic.
So on the cyber side, we need to step it up a little bit there and
get
them in a better spot.
Yeah. Point being is that they always, when you see them, you're like, there's probably going to be a pen testing story to come out of this.
Oh, yeah. And they know it, too.
Know they have the sprawling environment. They've got, like you said, like they've got three IT guys managing 20 schools,
in
a massive county kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. So that was one of the more interesting ones that we did a little while back. But
yeah.
So.
Would you say that, going back to the stages of pen testing, where you get your attack surface management down, and then you just kind of like a preliminary pen test, maybe you do a white box pen test before you do any black box pen testing too? I feel like there's the pen testing spectrum of like a black box pen test where you just kind of drop us in the network and don't give us anything is fine, but it's like about as close to red teaming as you can get, because it's a no knowledge, but it's not covert.
Right.
If there was any attempt at being surreptitious, you'd be red teaming.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily serve you as much as, again, going back to when we try to get a real bang for your buck pen test running for companies that may not have the budget but know that they need to, you're always trying to convince them that you need a white box.
Yeah, you want that, you know, collaborative, like, aspect, like you working
want,
together.
Yeah, you want to talk to us as we're doing it, and you want to give us credentials, because if you're worried about your bottom line, you don't want to be billing us to write and pack fully undetectable malware when we could just be telling you that you have a gas boy that's plugged in that's going to topple your whole network.
Sure.
And we can find that in a day or we can find it in a week, and it all depends on how willing you are to give us information to cut out the recon and the scanning and all of the other, mm-hmm. or as much of that kind of automated blah stuff as we can to cut to the chase. So the question I was going to ask is, we get in, these guys paid for, was it a week or 2 weeks?
I can't remember. I think it was 2 weeks.
They paid for a significant amount of testing time. Do you think in hindsight that, like, they should have gotten a pen test? Or where on the spectrum of security maturity do you think you would have put them? Do you think it was warranted to do a pen test for all of that? Or should we have approached them? Because
they had done it in the past.
They had gotten pen tests before?
As far as I'm aware, they had done it in the past with other organizations.
Wow. Okay.
But I would say on that scale of things, they would have been, in my opinion, on that side of vulnerability management to a very white box scenario, collaborative, like low end of the pen test side. Let's work together and check off all that really quote unquote simple to fix stuff.
Yeah, you need a good
before
foundation.
We go deeper than that. I think that's where probably a lot of school districts are. That's a conversation that we have a lot with organizations just in general, where they come and they say, like, I want to know what somebody on the internet could do to us. And it's like, well, great, we can do that.
Yeah.
But let's make sure that it makes sense for you. Let's make sure that's practical, because if you're going to just pay us to do all this research on you and do all this OSINT and lookups and trying to find that, we're happy to spend the time, but it's not going to be as valuable as what are the actual things that we end up doing or that we can end up doing.
Yeah.
So if we can fast forward some of that and focus on those real practical components, it ends up resulting in much better use of the time and the money.
Yeah, I agree. I said this in the last episode too about physical pen testing, where I think that's the same for red teaming. Is if you're getting a physical pen test or you're red teaming, like, there's a very small target market for people who are truly ready for that kind of assessment.
Yep.
I pretty much am always trying to go for the white box assessment anyway. I really think that is just the better way. The collaborative testing approach is the best way. Even if you have a mature stance, who's really out there who hates saving money, you know? Like, what are we talking about? Why would you not? If you can get someone on your end to take 4 or 5 hours and give us information that's going to save you 2 or 3 days of testing, who, raise your hand if you hate saving money.
Right.
No one's putting their hand up. So, I don't know.
I think we covered everything for that school district. I mean, we've had others that were very similar, but not to the extent of where one system toppled everything else. To recap here, we have that maturity level of security. And to me, going back on that, I would say that it's, I don't know how quickly it would drop off, but for organizations at large, based on the history that we've had performing these assessments, I would say most organizations fall somewhere between the upper end of vulnerability management and the beginning to middle of that pen testing side of things. And then it drops off pretty quick on the ones that need the red teaming or that are ready for that level of engagement, right?
Yeah, this is true. There's a video by Drew Porter. If you're into physical security, Porter Tradecraft on YouTube. It's a shameless plug. He's a cool guy. But he was like, most organizations that consider themselves to be high security are usually medium to low security organizations. There's a real disconnect between where they think they are and where they actually are. You know, I agree. I think if you are looking to get a pen test, you probably don't need a red team assessment.
Sure.
You don't. You might think you need a red team assessment.
Well.
But
Let's talk about it, right?
Yeah.
If you think you do, let's see where you're at. If you're thinking about engaging an organization with something like that, have that discussion, right?
Yeah.
Talk to them about what you have in place.
Yeah.
And see if what they offer aligns with where you feel your security is. Because if there's that disconnect there, there's some organizations that'll come out similar to what we do, where they're like, hey, we just do red teaming. If you want us, you're getting a red team assessment.
Yeah.
And organizations are like, great, that's the best thing that you can get, right? And it's like,
That's the word that we saw in the pamphlet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then they'll come in, and then the red team assessment will go through. They'll do everything that they're meant to do. And then there's not a lot of practical value because there's so many of these lower hanging things that the organization didn't even think of and weren't aware of, that they're just like, cool, well, we just spent like way more money on a red team because those red team assessments get more expensive as you go up that level.
For sure.
So you're paying a lot more and you're getting less practicality. Mm-hmm. So it's really important for organizations, if you think about that, to consider those things that we talked about here. Where are you at with your security? And then what's going to get you to that next level based on your maturity and in the programs that you have in place, and then finding offerings that really allow you to really step up into those additional levels.
Yeah. We'll say it till we're blue in the face.
I know. And that doesn't have to
be
us. Till
we're Maltech blue in the face.
There's lots of companies out there that are great at doing this, and there's some that are just really focused on doing one thing. So it's important to take that into consideration.
Yeah, man.
As we get close to wrapping up here, what's on your agenda? Anything new coming up? I don't think we don't have any conferences.
Sorry, I can't think past my next meal because I haven't eaten yet today.
Lunch, so, that's what's coming up?
Yeah, when you're like, what's on the agenda? I was like, buffet. I don't know. I wrapped a pen test yesterday. I have one still running that I'm probably going to finish by the end of the week. Back when I started, I wrote this disgusting bash script. I think I've told you about this. When I first started, I just had notes. And I was like, these are nmap commands that I like. And I was just copying and pasting them into the terminal. I was like, wow, I am so efficient.
Yeah.
And then one day I was like, oh, bash scripts exist, you know? And so I wrote this nasty bash script that automates a lot of recon and basic auditing. And for externals, it'll check the MX records and stuff. It'll do all that automatically. But then I hit a wall because I had one client where they had their SPF records misconfigured. SPF is one of the email protection record systems, whatever. Very high level, slightly inaccurate view of that. But you list valid servers in the record where emails can originate from. And when the record gets checked, you can put IP addresses, which are the physical servers, or you can just put like domain names. And if you have a domain name in there, that gets a separate lookup.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hard limit of 10 lookups per record to prevent infinite looping, right? Just you're chasing your tail through the records. They had their SPF record for their domain. It had a recursion problem. And so when that happens, the failsafe is to just not implement the protection at all. The record just fails. And I was like, oh, I can't look that up. I can't do that bash because doing that kind of tree searching is not really something that you should do. So Seth, back when I first met you in Ithaca Sec, was telling me, like, if you're using for loops in a bash script, you're using the wrong language, which I just did not listen to. And then I was like, oh, I need some sort of class structure to work this out. And I was like, well, what would be a funny bit? I'll write it in Bash++, which is a transpiler of Bash that lets you write Bash scripts that have classes. It's object-oriented Bash.
Oh, God.
A hilarious bit. But no, here's the cool thing. Here's the cool thing is that you write Bash++, and when you compile it, it transpiles down to Bash. So it writes this incredibly convoluted, fully valid bash script that allows you to have object-oriented programming structure.
Yep.
And I was like, that's really funny. I should do that. And then I was like, this is a very drawn-out bit for something that I am doing for work. I need this done effectively now more than I need it done funny.
Yep.
And so I'm rewriting everything in Python. Classic phone it in.
Perfect.
but I'm rewriting all of those tools. And that's actually – believe it or not, when you use a real programming language to write tools, your life gets really easier because then it's like, oh, I can integrate APIs into this. I can build a whole suite of reconnaissance tooling and write-up automation without having to just dump it all into standard out or some sort of CSV file amalgamation. I could use a real database. Oh my gosh. So that's my big longitudinal goal for this first half of the year is getting that all moved over and running smoothly so that when I get into Q4, I can...
When everything goes off the rails.
Basically, yeah. Just
you're
like
more prepared.
Press a button and have a good 10 to 12 hours of my life
just running for it.
What would be really cool is if I could hook it into OpenBus somehow or whatever phone scanner. I know you're toying with the idea of getting a new one. But if I could hook
evaluating some others.
If I could hook it into whatever Voln scanner we're using so that it could automatically set up a testing task. See, this is the problem. Think of things and then I write them down on my list and my list is getting longer and longer.
Classic scope creep.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be awesome if my tool did this?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, that might take me 20 hours. But yeah, that's my big thing. And then just overbooking until the work thins out.
Sure.
Or just overbooking until I'm forced to be overbooked anyway.
That's more of a reflection on me, I think.
Is it?
Keeping you busy.
I mean, yeah, it's a good reflection, right? I'd rather we have work to do than be like shaking a cup in the streets of Syracuse. Pen tests. Does anybody need a pen test? No, man. I don't got anything for you. Ugh.
Yeah. Not till Q4.
I guess I'll go do DevOps or some buzzword thing. I don't know. What do DevOps people do? What is a platform engineer?
Oh, gosh. That's not part of our podcast.
Another episode.
That's somebody else. Well, I appreciate you coming out again. It's been fun. You didn't have to break in this time.
He buys me lunch every time, so can't say no.
Yeah. If nothing else, you get fed for this.
And I didn't do this last episode. I am putting gas in my tank on my company card.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Cool. Well, appreciate it. Thanks for telling us about the story there, bringing that in. We'll have to do another one sometime.
You had to drag it out of me.
Yeah. Also, thanks to Danny and Mike producing here at Growth Mode Media. Shout out to those guys.
Danny and Mike!
Taking care of us, setting up this awesome space here.
Dude, I heard you guys whispering over the notes. Is everything all right? He said cut that shit. All right.
If you got a good story to tell about one of the engagements, reach out to us.
We need guests.
Contact at meltechsolutions.com.
If you don't come out and speak on this podcast, I will keep speaking. And that's a threat and a promise.
I think they like you. So we may not have anybody.
We've got tens of viewers.
Tens.
My mom, my godfather. I don't know.
Okay. Well, with that,
hopefully more.
Until next month.
Until next month.
See you later.